Amen. All right.
All right. Thanks again, you guys.
All right. So if you are new here this morning, I just want to let you know this is sort of a down week, meaning that, you know, we gave out a few small gift cards. No big deal. Next week, we're going to be giving away a free car. And I just want you to know, like, you have to come back. The week after that, you're going to get a large truck. We'll give away that. This is what we do, though, as a church. And I've been preaching this for 3 years, that really, since I've been here, I really want us to believe that whatever God gives us, whoever we are, like, your talents, your resources, everything that you are, God didn't just give that for you. He didn't just give it for your family. He gave it for this second family that we've been talking about for the last 4 weeks. And that one family actually forms you, which is your physical family that you grow up in. They form how you think. They form how you process life. They form your worldview. But the family that transforms you is the family that says, whatever I am, all that I am, all my life for your life. That we would take our life and say, God, make us a family of God that leverages who we are for the gift and for the glory of you through the neighborhood. May people actually see it that way. That's what we're about. And I couldn't be more proud. I feel like this was an amazing event on Wednesday night. And on a night that can be seen as a night as darkness and dark masks and a lot of unknowns. And in a world where parents are actually sometimes fearful of going door to door, God has done something here over the last number of years to say, this is safe. This is where we want you. I like the fact that the neighborhood is saying the church, like we're the only one around. I love it. I love it. And we're not the only one around, but we are the church in this neighborhood. God put us here for a reason, for a time and a place such as this today. So give yourself one more hand for what God has done among you and among our team. So we're in this series, we're in the fourth week. This is the final week of this series, and I'm actually going to start my timer because we are going to be we don't have a clock anymore, so I'm going to be right here. Actually, I'm going to have my daughter hold it, and you can just keep it somewhere near you, and when I get to the numbers that start flashing red, yeah, let me know. Just kind of wave at me and say, Dad. So the big idea of this series is really about, it's the title called The Origin of Family, and that we as a church are a family. But it's not the only family you were given. You were given, as I just said, you were given a family. And it was a family that you did not choose. In fact, some of you, if you were to rewrite your story today and go back and say, this is the family that was given to me, but it's not the family that I ever wanted. It's not the family I dreamed of. I wish that I could just rewrite my family story. And if you could rewrite your family story, what would you write? But there's another family, and it's this family. And it's the family that you didn't choose, or that wasn't just handed to you. It wasn't the family that you looked at and said, I didn't ask for this. This is the family that you actually get to choose. This is the family that you get to be adopted into, and that we see each other as if we would see each other as family. Like legitimately, like this morning, a little boy came running up to me, put his arms around me just at the back of the church, and he said, Donnie, I want you to know you're my favorite. That little boy is not my little boy as in blood and flesh, but he is in spirit and truth my son. He's a child of mine. He is a family member to me. And I want to treat him like that. And I want us to treat each other like that. I want us to see each other not as just commodities in a church that hopefully will go somewhere. And if I have them in there, they're high influence and they're going to do something for us and they're going to actually lead us. No, I want to see every person in this place to be viewed as their favorite, as my favorite, as your favorite. that there is no dividing lines, no cultural dividing lines, no skin color that divides those lines, no socioeconomic status that actually divides those lines, nothing. God actually gave us one family, but he gave us two. The first one formed you, the second one will transform you if you allow it. So this is not a series of messages, as I've said over and over. What this is we've connected each week, and I want you to hear this. So if you missed the rest of the messages, they're all online. You can go listen to them, because you're getting the end of the story this morning. This is a love story from the Lord. This is a love story from God. This is not just sermons. So please take it that way. Understand that what I'm going to tell you today is really the end of the story that actually started at the beginning of the story. We're going to take a family that we're going to look at. We're going to look at the family story early on in a big biblical account, and we're going to go back to that family. And as I have said, there are not a lot of really good families in the Bible. If you're aware of the Bible, if you've read the Bible, you will find out that most of the families in the Bible, especially the Old Testament, are pretty jacked up. Like, they're pretty messed up. In fact, there is a lot that went wrong in those families. But you know what happens in those families is almost all of them, by the willpower, by the submission of those people, say it, that they would say, God can redeem this. And he always redeems us. He always redeems family. And when you see God redeeming family, what you actually find him doing is he's actually beginning to tell you, this is what Christ looks like. So if you go back into the family line history, you will find that there is a storyline that is very, very closely related to the story of Jesus, the way Jesus would act, the way that he would actually work within our lives. So this family right here has an ability to transform you, but it doesn't just transform you. This family has the ability to transform a neighborhood, a culture, a world. And it's only limited by your ability to dream big enough or not dream big enough. What will you bring into the next generation? So the title of the message this morning is called The Family Echo, The Family That Echoes. Because here's why. You, right now, are someone else's previous generation. You're someone's previous generation, both physically, by blood, and by spiritually in this church family. You are somebody's previous generation. Somebody will look back on you and I and they will say, do you remember Aunt Rhonda? No, I don't. Let me tell you about Aunt Rhonda. She was absolutely gorgeous. And man, she could make a pot of pasta and sauce that was supposedly just like her mom's and her grandmother's. And her great-grandmother's. Like, I guess it was amazing. But she was beautiful. Do you remember who she was married to? You remember Uncle Donnie? You ever hear of Uncle Donnie? Yeah, I heard a lot about him. I heard he was like that smelly guy, you know what I mean? Like, this is what happens. Like, my parents were influenced by their parents. Their parents were influenced by their parents. And the family line continues. In fact, I would bet that if you sat down at a coffee shop right now, today, and somehow had some amazing miracle that somebody from four generations in your past, in your bloodline, was able to sit at that coffee shop, sit right next to you, and you guys all began to have a conversation, you know what would happen? Somebody at that table would look at the two of you and say, I don't know what's going on, but I think the two of you are like related. Because there is a connection from generation to generation. And the same is true when it comes to our spiritual families. What we do today will actually become somebody else's previous generation. The Apostle Paul tells us that. And he tells us how we can actually become a quality future generation. A future generation, a future family that is to become. And he says it in Colossians 3, and I'm going to read this out of the message. These are the passages we've been reading over the last 3 weeks. So chosen by God for this new life of love. And he says, dress in the wardrobe God picked out for you. So that's why I have these clothes over here. Don't just choose the clothes that you're going to put on. Don't just choose the life that you should live. Actually allow God to choose it for you. And he chooses it for you by the attributes of who God is and by the attributes of who Jesus is and by the attributes of who Paul was. These attributes are important for you to put on every single day. He says, dress in this new life of love, dress in the wardrobe God handpicked out for you, compassion, kindness, humility, quiet strength, discipline. And then he says, be even tempered, content with second place, quick to forgive an offense. Forgive as quickly and completely as your master has forgiven you in this last passage in verse 14. And regardless of what else, in fact, another translation says, above all. Make sure you do this. Put on love. Wear love. It's your basic all-purpose garment. Love is the new black, as I said in week one, right? It's slimming. It just works on everybody. It's the all-purpose garment. And then it says, never be without it, like a good Allstate commercial. It's your insurance for the future. It's what you write. So when I think about my family and I think about my grandfather, as Noah talked just a bit about, and I think about my dad and my mom and my grandpa and my great-grandfather, which I don't know much about, here's what's interesting. When people ask you about your family today, I want us to stretch our mindset beyond what Western culture would say is your family. Because if somebody came to you and said, hey, tell me about your family, you know what you would say? Well, I'm married and I have 3 children or 4 children, right? That's what you would say. It's today. You don't say, my last name's Hinshaw, and my grandfather, my great-great-grandfather did this and this and this, and my great-grandpa did this. You don't go into your history. You don't go into your lines. But if you actually go into other parts of the world and they actually ask you about your family, that is where they start. They don't just talk about their mom and their dad. They don't just talk about their siblings. They talk about their family line. They talk about the generations that actually gave them something. And so when I think about my own family, the influence that my grandparents left, my great-grandparents left, and this long history, the influence that they gave me was an influence that was based around this church family. It was one of their highest priorities, and I'm so grateful for it. People can say, like, I was spoon-fed this. It was like they put on church. They put church on me. Really, what they did is they didn't put a system on me. They put love on me. That's what they did. That's what church stands for. And so my grandfather, early on in his life, he was a teenager, and he was going to a church in Rose Hill, Kansas, a friend's church in Rose Hill, Kansas, a suburb of Wichita. And the church was really small, tiny little country church. There was no students in the youth group. They had this youth group of 2 or 3 kids, and they said, we have got to reach the next generation. Funny, that's what we keep saying. We got to reach the next generation. We got to get the youth in the room. We have to somehow do that. So they hired this guy to come in from Texas, and he was an evangelist. My dad told me his name, and I forget. I think his last name was Haskins. And Mr. Haskins comes into town, and he puts together this weekend revival service where they had pie socials and ice cream socials, and supposedly it was supposed to bring all these kids in the door. My grandfather gave his life to the Lord that weekend. About 30 years later, fast forward, he runs into Mr. Haskins later on in life, and he sees him at a conference, and he comes up to him, and he says, I just want to tell you thank you. He said, for what? And he goes, you remember those years way back in Rose Hill, Kansas, you actually did a revival service for a bunch of youth? And he goes, oh, that was the worst time of my life. There was no kids that showed up. They brought me in all the way from Texas. Nobody came. In fact, it was so embarrassing because the night that I did that altar call, 1 kid came forward. My grandpa looked at him and he said, just so you know, Mr. Haskins, that 1 kid was me. And I'm grateful for what you did. You know what I'm grateful for? Mr. Haskins. I'm grateful for my grandpa. I'm grateful for my family. I'm grateful for the legacy that they left. I'm grateful that my grandfather was one of the ones that flew in on a plane with another man at Camp Quaker Ridge and got off the plane and looked around a little bit and said, this is beautiful, I think this will do. And now we have a campground there. You know what I never, ever remember very much? I don't remember the great things my grandpa said, but I will never forget the things he did. I started to think about the things that he said. Couldn't come up with many. I want to show you a couple. Here's what he said. One day when we're driving to this building right here, through the neighborhood, he said, Donnie, Northwest Friends Church is the fastest growing Friends Church in Arvada. Don't you ever forget that. And then he said to me, It's the only Friends Church in Arvada, but it is the fastest growing Friends Church in Arvada. And I was like, oh, that's funny, Grandpa. Next one, this is what he said, and this is how my grandpa lived his life. He said, if God tells you to run through a brick wall, lower your head and pray that he makes a way. Just go. And that's how he led ministry. That's how he lived. I have a hard time remembering some of the unbelievable things he might have said. In fact, some of the things he said, I just remember the jokes. I remember the puns. But I don't remember the amazing things that might have been transforming. But I do remember the things that he did, and those are transforming. You are who you are, not for yourself, not just for today, but for a future generation. You are today building a legacy for tomorrow, for somebody else's tomorrow, for somebody else's family. One of the greatest family echoes is this story that I'm going to talk about this morning. And go all the way back to Father Abraham. How many of you even know the song? Father Abraham, many sons have Father Abraham, and I'm one of them, and so are you. So let's just praise the Lord, right arm, right. Yeah, you remember that? It's like, man, that was praise music when I was a kid. We're like, force people to raise their hands, you know what I mean? But it's this like long line story, this song that tells a story about family and how important family is. So take a look at this image here. I'll show you. Nope. That's my grandpa's church. 1920, 1954, 1955, building legacy in Denver Friends. He was a pastor here. Just shows you the generational legacy that he left. Go on to pass the next couple slides. Here you go. So this is a story we're going to talk about. Abraham. You know the story of Abraham. He was the starting point. So I'll just give you the starting point. Genesis chapter 12, 1 through 3. The Lord says to Abraham at the very top, he says to Abraham, he says, leave your country and your relatives and your what? Father's family. And go to the land that I will show you, and I will make you into a great nation. So suddenly the family doesn't just become the family. It actually becomes a great nation. It actually builds cultures. It actually builds and transforms nations. I will bless you and make you famous, and you will be a blessing to others. Get that one right. I will bless you, and sometimes that's where we stop. But he says, I am going to bless you so that you will bless others. Your blessing that I give you, leverage to bless somebody else. It never stops with you. You will be a blessing to others, and I will bless those who bless you and curse those who treat you with contempt. That's the passage we really like, right? But look at the next one. He says, all the families on earth. Now, who are all the families on earth? All of them. Not just yours, not just America's, not just this country's, not just your Republican friends, not just because you're a Democrat, not just because of a political preference. All the families in human history will be blessed by this family. God is saying, I'm starting a new family from Genesis 12, early on. All the families would be blessed through you. And then later in Exodus, it says, now you will obey me and keep my covenant. You will be my own special treasure. That's really good news. I like to know that my family's God's own special treasure. From among all the peoples on the earth and from the earth, that the earth belongs totally to me. It's mine. I'll do what I want with it. And I'm going to do something really amazing through you if you will give me the allegiance, if you give me the submission, if you'll give me your heart. I will actually use your life to bless people. It's going to be powerful. So Joseph, so go back to that slide. So we have Abraham, who is the father, who was the father of Isaac. He had a son named Isaac, and then we have Jacob and Esau. These are the two that he gave birth to, and so here's how we say that, right? We don't say Esau and Jacob, we say Jacob and Esau. But in reality, it's Esau and Jacob, and the reason why it's Esau and Jacob is because Esau was born first. Esau was the firstborn child who had all the family rights. In fact, so much of a family right that he would have and inherit a double portion at the end of his father's life, and he would be the patriarch of the family. He would be the family judge. He would be the one who would rule. So this is a patriarchal system that we don't work through anymore because Jesus came and redeemed that. And some of you are going, but I'm the first son. I want that, right? I'm telling you that's not true anymore because I'm the second son. And so he has Esau and Jacob. And we'll get to that story in a minute. But then he has this son named Joseph. So he has all these boys, 11 boys. And Joseph is the favorite. He gets the jacket. He gets the father's favor in some reason, even though he's not the firstborn son. But here's why this is important. Because the other day I had somebody tell me, they said, I just want a family that's a biblical family. I just want my family to be biblical. I want us to just grow in the grace of God. And you know what I asked him? I said, do you know what that means? Because if you want a biblical family, I don't know what biblical family you want to be a part of, but they're all nasty. They just don't work. So be careful when you say biblical family. No, just say you want to be a family of grace. I want to be a family of God's grace. And so Joseph, here's why I say that. Because Joseph is the son. He is the son of Jacob's favorite wife. How would you like to be in that family? Not the first wife, but the favorite wife. You're my favorite wife, and this is your son. He's my son. He's my favorite son because you're my favorite wife. Not you. You're my second favorite wife. You're my third favorite wife, and you're my fourth favorite wife. But don't worry. I'll spend time with all of you. You know what I mean? Like, it's messed up. It's just a messed up system. And so Joseph, who has this favor for, or Jacob, who has this favor for Joseph, he starts sending Joseph out on these missions to actually spy on his brothers. He says, go out and be with your brothers for a little bit. Come back and tell me what they're doing. I want to know what they're doing. I trust you, Joseph. So he does this multiple times. Joseph is about 17 years old, and he's had a lifetime of doing this, snitching on his brothers. And he calls me, he says, Joseph, go check on him. He goes and looks. They're not in the place they're supposed to be. You know that little brother, right? What's interesting about this is he was the little brother without the last one born yet. So he was the favored kid. He was the baby brother. How many of you guys have a baby brother? How many times did you say that baby brother was spoiled? Raise your hands. How many of you know the baby gets spoiled? He was spoiled, and he told him, go out and check on him. He goes out and spies. He goes, they're not there. Wait till I tell Dad. And then he goes and he actually finds them in the place that they're not supposed to be because they're supposed to be over here working, and they're not there. And then he goes, and as he's approaching them, all the brothers look at him and goes, here he comes, the dreamer boy, the snitch, the family narc, a little spoiled brat. Here he is. And they start scheming, and they said, I'm sick of this. How about you? Yeah, me too. I'm sick of this. I'm tired of him trying to actually take all the father's love. I'm sick of this. Let's be done with him. Good idea. Let's be done with him. Let's kill him. You want to kill him? Yeah? Sounds good to me. Let's kill him. And then suddenly mercy starts to show up. Some compassion and mercy. And they're like, well, let's not kill him. That would be bad. Throw him in a well and decide, but maybe we just want to sell him. We'll stage his death. Looks like we killed him. And then we'll make some money off of him. Sell him off. Great idea. Awesome idea. So they put blood of an animal on this coat, this favored coat. He put some of his blood on this coat, and they take it back to the dad, and they say, Dad, don't know what happened. We found this coat out there laying around, and it's got an animal's blood on it, and it's got Joseph's blood on it, Dad. But don't worry, Dad. I think he put up quite a fight. Look at all the blood of that animal on there. You can be proud of your favorite son, Dad, from your favorite wife. Imagine what happened. And you know what happens is we romanticize these stories. You know why? Because we don't have the five senses to be in that story. We can't touch it, we can't feel it, we can't taste it, we can't see it. We can't understand it, we can't know it, right? So we romanticize it, and now there's plays on Joseph the Technicolor Dreamcoat. Imagine the emotional stress of Joseph being sold by his brothers and being brought into slavery. And here's what you have to know. He was shackled, probably drugged behind camels for miles, tortured, beaten, bloodied, probably broken bones, forced to work, forced to have calluses on his hands, sold from slave owner to slave owner. And he finally makes his way to Egypt, and he makes his way because of faith. He makes his way because in the middle of adversity, the blessings of God that everybody thought that he had in the beginning were suddenly starting to be dismissed. Everything that was a blessing no longer looked like a blessing. It looked as if God had no favor on Joseph, and somehow in the middle of that, Joseph still believed that God was with him. And he makes it. He makes it to Egypt, because when you have faith through adversity, it becomes a really, 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 really amazing image to everybody else. It becomes attractive and alluring. It becomes that thing that everybody says, I don't know what he's got, but I want that. And he gets the attention of a man by the name of Potiphar. But not only does he get the attention of a man by the name of Potiphar, he gets the attention of Potiphar's wife. Potiphar is a captain in Pharaoh's army. Potiphar is up in the military. He's got power. You would think that suddenly it's swaying in his direction, like the favor starts to come back. In fact, it looks like favor's coming back because Potiphar's wife, who is supposedly this beautiful woman from Africa, and she starts to get the attention of Joseph. She gets his attention, and she looks at him, and she's like, I like you a lot. I want you to be my boy. And he's like looking at her going, you got to be kidding me. Hold on the phone. I like you too. You're beautiful, but it would displease my master, who, by the way, is your husband. You're married. Oh. But it would also displease my father. Faith keeps you grounded in the things that you know are leading you to favor. You know what happened to her? She got a little irritated because he liked him a lot. And she accuses him of seducing her and raping her. The very next thing, he finds himself in an Egyptian dungeon. And now he's not just a slave. He's a slave and a prisoner. There's a big difference between being a prisoner and being a slave and a prisoner. A slave has absolutely no rights. A prisoner actually goes to prison and eventually is waiting trial. He has no option for trial coming for him. He's in a nasty Egyptian dungeon with no hope. Joseph continued to live as if God was with him, even if it looked like God was completely against him and had abandoned him. Joseph continued to do the right thing, even though the right thing was not done to Joseph. He kept making great decisions to follow God. So, strange verse happens. Listen, Genesis 39:21. Listen to what it says. But the Lord was with Joseph. That's good news, isn't it? He's in an Egyptian dungeon. The Lord was with Joseph in the prison and showed him his faithful love. Good. That's great. Look at this. And the Lord made Joseph a favorite. I love being the favorite. Good news. With the prison warden. How many of you, if you were in Egyptian prison and the prison warden was showing you some favor because he threw you an extra loaf of sourdough, how many of you would be in that prison cell going, yes, the prison warden loves me. Man, I'm blessed. I'm so blessed right now. Can you imagine you having that type of faith that somehow in the darkest place of your life, you're coming back to that place and you're saying, I have great faith. The prison warden showed me that he actually likes me. That has to be God. Has to be God. What kind of faith does Joseph have to have? What kind of faith does he have to actually live like that? And furthermore, where did that faith actually come from? Time goes on, Pharaoh gets really angry. He gets frustrated because he's got two guys, including one of his guys is a cupbearer, and he does something wrong. And if you're a cupbearer, that means you're the assistant. You do everything that he tells you to do. And he does something wrong. The cupbearer and another guy show up in the dungeon prison in Egypt with Joseph. Joseph's got lots of time to think in the dungeon. He's got a lot of time to just sit down there. And you know what he develops? This amazing gift to be able to interpret dreams. Why? Because he's just dreaming about being out. He starts dreaming. He starts having his own nightmares. He starts having his own dreams, his own visions. And God starts to speak to him through his dreams and visions. And he gives him this unique gift to be able to take somebody else's dreams and interpret them. So these two guys show up and the cupbearer, he's down in the prison and he's staying up at night crying out for mom. You know, he's just like, Mom, I really wish you were here right now. And he's having these nightmares and these dreams, and he wakes up, and Joseph says, I can interpret your dream. Okay, go. God's going to restore you back to Pharaoh as his cupbearer. That's amazing. You really think so? Yeah. It begins to happen. And he goes and he tells him, listen to me. I've been down here a long time. When you get restored back to Pharaoh, will you just put in a good word for me? Will you let him know that I'm down here? I'm still here. I'm not supposed to be here. I'm just a Hebrew boy. I'm not an Egyptian. I don't even talk or walk like an Egyptian. I can't even sing that song. Right? I don't belong here. I was accused. And I was accused wrongly. Just go tell him. I'll do it. He's restored. And the scriptures tell us that he never says a word to Pharaoh. Forgets about Joseph altogether. 2 years pass. 2 years pass. And he's waiting in the dungeon. And his only hope, the warden likes me. The warden likes me. The warden likes me. That's my hope. 2 years into his dream, Pharaoh has a dream. Or 2 years in the dungeon, Pharaoh has a dream. Pharaoh starts dreaming. And he's like, man, this is an important dream. I got to get it interpreted. Somebody's got to. And here's his cupbearer standing next to him. He goes, you need a dream interpreted? Yeah. I totally forgot about that guy down in the dungeon. Hey, I just, so you remember when I was, like, you didn't like me? I want to forget that moment. But I don't want you to forget the fact that there was a guy down there, and his name's Joseph. He's a Hebrew, and he interpreted my dream. And you know what he said? I would actually be next to you again, and I would be restored as your cupbearer, and it worked. I'm just saying, if you want somebody to actually interpret your dream, yeah, you should call on him. Go get him. They clean him up. They give him a shave. They give him a nice haircut. They take him to a grooming party. He gets an alarm on his phone that says it's time for you to be done preaching. And he told him, he said, listen, he said, here you go. He's down there, he's waiting. And so they give him this haircut, they start trimming his nails, they clean him up, they put a nice Egyptian threaded suit on him from Men's Warehouse, and he starts showing up and he's got tattoos all over and he's got makeup and he looks like an Egyptian, he's walking like an Egyptian, but he's still not singing that song. And he comes to Pharaoh, and he's standing in the palace courtyard with and in front of the most powerful man in the entire world. And Pharaoh says, it has been told that the gods are in favor of you, and that you have a unique ability to transform and interpret dreams. And Pharaoh says something that is absolutely stupid, that no man should ever say in front of the most powerful man in the entire world. And he looks at him and he says, I can't interpret your dreams, but my God can. The guy you're talking to thinks he's God. Immediately, the guards start to pull out their swords and they raise them. They're going to take him out. and he says, stand down. Let him tell me what he needs to tell me. And he says, okay, I got it. Here it is. For 7 years, Egypt is going to be completely in a place where the grains and the rains and everything, the crops are just going to go crazy. For 7 years, it will flourish. There's going to be so much grain to actually deal with, you're not even going to know what to do with it. I'm telling you, here's what you got to do. You got to save it. You got to hold on to it. You got to put it in some silos. Not only that, but you should actually start charging people 20% tax. Charge them. Charge them for the grain that is being stored. Hold on to it. This is what you're going to have to do, because here's what's going to happen. On the eighth year, day one, famine is going to start to hit. There's going to be no more rains for 7 more years. Egypt is going to be in trouble. And if you don't take care of the first 7 years, you're going to be in trouble in the second 7. I'm just telling you. And then he says something even more stupid. He said, let me tell you what to do, Pharaoh. What you need to do is you actually better find an administrator, somebody who actually can administrate all this stuff, somebody who can actually store this stuff in silos, somebody who will actually tax the people. And here's what's going to happen in those 7 years. People are going to start taxing, and you are going to get rich. You need somebody to manage that for you. He said, because on the eighth year, day one, this is what's going to happen. People are going to starve. And when they come back, make them buy the grain back. You're going to get richer. You better have an administrator. You better actually find somebody who knows what to do. Because in the end, here's what's going to happen. The neighboring countries are going to be starving too. And guess what's going to happen? They're all going to come looking for grain, and they're going to need to buy grain. And everybody, all the palace guards, everybody's standing around, and they just go, that is like a beer commercial. They're like, brilliant. That's brilliant. That's amazing. And he looks at me, he goes, is there anyone in the entire land that is more wise and powerful than the man that stands right before us? And on that day, Joseph, who was sold into slavery by his brothers, actually became second in command in Egypt, and he became the prime minister. Everything that happens after that happens just as expected. First 7 years are amazing. Joseph's in command. He's actually leading and helping lead Pharaoh, and he's taxing people. He's taking in all the money. The country's getting rich. And on day one of the eighth year, it just goes completely downhill as expected. Everybody starts starving. Joseph is standing in line, taking everybody's money, and then neighboring countries start to come. Guess what happens? His family members, his brothers that sold him into slavery, are starving to death in Canaan. And they had no choice but to go to Egypt and buy grain. And there's one man waiting for them to take their check. Take a look at this. Genesis 42:5. So Jacob's sons, are now called Israel, arrived in Egypt along with others to buy food for the famine in Canaan. Famine was in Canaan as well. And in verse 6, since Joseph was governor of all of Egypt and in charge of selling grain to the people, it was to him that his brothers showed up, that they came. And when they arrived, they bowed before him with their faces to the ground. And Joseph recognized his brothers instantly. In a moment, he recognized the voices that laughed at him. In a moment, he recognized the voices that wanted to steal his inheritance. He recognized the voices that wanted him dead, that threw him into a well and abandoned him. In a moment, he could actually again begin to rewind his life back to a point where he could hear the coins clinking in somebody's hand as they sold the brother to somebody else. In this moment, Joseph has the ability to bless or curse his own family members. And Joseph remembered something else a scene from his childhood that goes way back. So I'm going to connect the dots here. I'm going to go backwards now. Rewind. Abraham, Isaac. Take a look at that slide again. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Esau. So Jacob and Esau, brothers. Esau is the firstborn. He's the one who gets the double share. Esau and Jacob are very different. Esau is kind of that tough mountain guy like Noah. He's like that tough guy with a beard. He likes to hunt. He likes to play in the woods. And Jacob, he likes to cook. He's a chef. He works in downtown at the Hyatt Regency. The other guy works, you know, Esau's up in the mountains, lives in Durango or something like that. A hairy guy, a big guy, a man's man. Very, very different. And Jacob, or Esau, is out hunting, and he doesn't get what he's hunting for. That happened to me a lot when I would hunt. I'd come home, and my wife would look at me, and she goes, "You're not good at this hunting thing." And I'm like, "Yeah, that's why it's called hunting, right? You keep hunting until you find something." Well, he had a really bad day, and he's starving, and he comes home, and Jacob made this amazing pot of stew. The place smells amazing. And Esau walks in, and he goes, "Whoa, man, I am starving. Could I get a bowl of your stew?" He goes, "No. Because I had a bad day, and I just get a bowl of your stew." The firstborn never asked the next child, the next brother down for something, ever, in that culture. He's self-sufficient. He doesn't need to. That's the rules. But in this moment, Jacob sees, and he knows, and he realizes something is about ready to happen. And he has the ability of blessing and curse in his own hands. And he says to him, "I'll give you a bowl of stew if you give me your birthright." They're teenagers, probably in junior high at the time. And so Esau, who doesn't have his frontal lobe fully developed yet at this point, he says, "Okay, I'll take the stew." And he's like mowing through the stew going, "This is awesome." And he gets done, and the empty bowl made him realize how empty his life was, because the scriptures actually said he despised his birthright. The story goes on. Later on, father, Isaac, is actually going to give the family their blessing. And this isn't just a prayer. It's not a bedtime story. It's not like lay your hand on your kid, pray over him at night. This, in this culture, was when the father bestowed the blessing on the child and on the children, he did it at once. And it was a legally binding act. And so he prays over them. He's having this moment, and he's about ready to pray for Esau. He's about ready to lay his hands on Esau to give him his prayer of blessing, to give him the double share, to make him the judge of the home, to make him the one who makes the decisions. And he suddenly begins to get ready to pray, and Jacob scoots in at the last second with the help of his mother, who put hair all over his arms. And Isaac is blind in the moment. He's old and decrepit, and he begins to lay his hand on his son, and he goes, and Jacob says, "I'm Esau, and I'm here to receive my blessing." "You don't sound like Esau." "Oh, Dad, you're blind too and deaf. I didn't know that." "I am Esau." And he prayed over him, and he gave him the blessing. And Jacob got the blessing that was due to Esau. The story continues that Esau goes to get his blessing, and the father says, "I already gave the blessing, and I can't revoke it. I did it once. I did it once. It's over with. I'm so sorry." And he's angry. He missed out. Genesis 27:41. "From that time on, Esau hated Jacob because their father had given Jacob the blessing. And Esau began to scheme, 'I will soon be mourning my father's death.'" So he said, "When Dad dies, my brother is dead. He's gone." And Isaac tells Jacob, "Jacob, you got to run. You got to run." Jacob runs, he leaves his family home, and he lives with an uncle for 20 years, and he marries a woman named Leah, and then he marries Rachel, and he marries another woman. Leah starts giving him son after son after son after son after son. Rachel can't give him a son. Rachel's barren in the moment, and she starts bringing him her maidservants. She keeps giving him all these women. Every time he comes home, there's a different woman. And he's like, "We got to have a child." Jacob, you got to have a child. Sleep with my maidservant. Okay. Right? Like, that's what he does. And he keeps sleeping with these different women over and over and over. And there's this moment where Joseph is born to Rachel, his favorite wife. And in Genesis 31:3, then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your father and your grandfather and your relatives there, and I will be with you. So for those 20 years, Jacob's family grows, his livestock grows, his inheritance grows. It is blessing after blessing. He's got a huge piece of the family dream. And it says, return to the land your father and your grandfather gave you. Return to it. Go back to it, Jacob, and I will be with you. And he said, you better be with me, because if I go back there, Esau is going to kill me. So he packs up his family and his livestock, and he goes on this long journey to get back to his original home, and he's thinking, man, if Esau's waiting for me, if he's there, it's over with. And Jacob knows. He knows what could happen, but he's trusting the Lord. Look at verse 1. Then Jacob looked up, and he saw Esau coming with 400 men. So as he's approaching, Esau hears that Jacob's coming with his family. And all of a sudden, he comes up over the hill, and this is like a view out of the Patriot movie. He's walking, and it's like Little House on the Prairie with his covered wagons and his little family and his livestock, and he thinks he's got it, and he looks up on the hill, and there's this massive group, 400 people. And these aren't family members. They're not coming for Thanksgiving. They're not coming for some carved turkey. They're coming for a moment with armed men, strong military men, and they're going to take him out, and Jacob knows it's done. And he knows if he retreats, everything's lost. And look at verse 1 of Genesis 33. He says, so he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and his two servant wives. And he put the servant wives, and I want you to catch this. This is super important. We're going to be done really quickly, I promise. He put the servant wives and their children at the front. Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph. Joseph is the only one mentioned. It's the only name mentioned in the entire line of the family of the brothers. It's the only one that is here. He puts Joseph last, and Joseph, look what it says in verse 3. It says, then Jacob went ahead as he approached his brother. He bowed to the ground 7 times. So Jacob, there's this span of this military army and Jacob's family, and Joseph, the only one mentioned of the 12 brothers, is sitting in the back, in the rear with Rachel. And there's this big open field in the middle, and he sees this army, and Jacob starts to go towards his brother and his army, and every few steps, he just goes, no, and he drops 7 times to his face. 7 times he falls on his face before his brother, and his brother, Esau, does the thing that nobody would expect, because he's got the power of blessing and curse in his hand. He has the ability to take him out if he wants to in a moment. Then Esau ran to meet him, and he embraced him, and he threw his arms around his neck, and he kissed him, and they both wept. Then Esau looked at the woman and the children and asked, who are these people that are with you? And he's like, Esau, this is my family. This is my family. God, they're beautiful. This is amazing. We're back together. We are a family again. Next came Leah and her children, and they bowed before, and finally Joseph and Rachel came forward, and they bowed before Esau. Now listen to me, here's where it comes. Joseph never forgot that moment. Joseph said, Uncle Esau saved my dad's life. Uncle Esau redeemed my home. Uncle Esau, even when it was bad and it looked like everything was against him, he had faith that he could redeem it with his brother. My brother, my dad, Jacob, has been saved. My life has been saved. I will always be a man of grace and mercy and great faith, and I will never stop giving the grace of God to people. That's the story he heard for his entire life. That was the story that he began to dress himself with mercy and compassion and humility and tenderness and grace. 30 years pass, 30 plus years pass, and Joseph becomes just like Esau, influenced by a story, something that somebody did, not something that somebody said, something that somebody accomplished. People will forget what you say, but they will never forget what you do. They might forget what you say. You can say, I love you, but until you show it, nobody will actually believe it. You can give grace by your words, but until you do it by your actions, they won't ever live it. Forgiveness is a powerful thing. Forgiveness is wrapped in love that actually gets you to believe that your future family will actually live just like that. And when he meets his brothers, because they come back for grain, I may look like an Egyptian, I may walk like an Egyptian, I may talk like an Egyptian, but I am a Hebrew and I am your brother and we are going to have a party. And they embrace. And the family's reunited. Moral of the story is, what you do today echoes into future generations. Say whatever you want. They'll probably forget it. Do whatever he calls you to do. They will never forget. Ask the worship team to come. Your children and your children's children will forget often what you say. They won't forget what you do. So here's the line I want to give you. Actions don't speak louder, don't only speak louder than your words. They sometimes echo into your eternity, into somebody else's eternity. You are somebody else's future generation or past generation. They are your future generation. What will you do that will echo from you? What will we do as a church that will echo from us into a future generation? They'll look back and they'll say, man, if those people didn't step up to the plate, we wouldn't be having what we have today. The power of love and forgiveness, blessings and curses are in our hands, and curses is the one thing that they'll never, ever, ever, ever be able to remove from them. But blessing is something they will live out. They will live out with power and authority in the family that they live in. Amen? Worship with us.